Hello, lovers. I'm Karen Tongson, filling in for Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Happy belated, sweetie.
Thank you, darling.
I hope you had a great birthday celebration.
It was very chill. It was
really?
Very low-key. That's not normal for me. So that was actually a celebration in not having a celebration.
And not having a hangover and
yeah,
the whole thing.
Yeah. I'm grown now.
I'm so thrilled. You know, like, I don't know if not yet a girl or I... Not, still a girl, not yet a woman. I don't know.
That's where I'm at, boo.
Okay, all right.
That's where I'm at.
I feel
crazy.
You. I feel you.
A little long, but I'm here.
And we've also got as our special guest, the Velvet Lawnmower himself, film critic Dave White.
Howdy.
Hello, sweetheart. How have you been doing?
I'm everybody's fourth favorite substitute
teacher.
Oh, No, not true. Not even true.
And I'm thrilled to be back.
Yay!
Every time I come back, I get so excited that I get to be here.
Plus, you brought baked goods.
Plus, again, I mean, I think it's Dave's secret plan to kill us all off through the slow inculcation of type 2 diabetes.
I want to bring love with me where I go.
I know, but my blood sugar rises the moment I see you confirm.
And I... And, you know, baking things is loving people.
So. Love. And that is the topic of this week's episode,
great
in fact.
KT.
Seriously, right? I'm good at this shit. Anyway, Dave brings the love because on this week's show, we're talking about VD. Get your minds out of the gutter. It's Valentine's Day.
It's for everybody.
It's for everybody. So we're going to talk about our favorite romances in TV and film. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest gems because you know that happens every week. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Dave, since you are here and you brought the love in the form of a bundt cake.
Yes.
Give us the love that you've got for what you're all about.
It's supper time with Maddie Matheson. Oh, God. I have not been in love with a cooking show like this for a long time because I watch them all of them, and I need instruction. And so I'm looking for that. And if your cooking show is poor in terms of delivering a way to make something good for dinner, I will stop watching you.
So you're not in it for the love of the competition or the lifestyle?
No. I don't watch the competition shows.
Oh.
I watch straight up, I'm going to teach you how to make a souffle.
Yeah. Mm. Okay.
I literally learned how to make a souffle from watching Ina Garten on television.
She teaches us so much.
She does. Well, now I love Maddie Matheson on Viceland. He has this great presentation. He is simultaneously a loud, manic bro chef, while also slyly fucking with those ideas. He breaks a lot of conventions of cooking shows in a way that is very similar to the first series that Nigella Lawson ever did, where you would watch her make things, stick her fingers in stuff, lick her fingers, you know, make mistakes, spill stuff, and then just charmingly look at the camera and say, well, that's what happens.
Let's correct with some salt.
And so what Maddie Matheson does, his manner is very similar to his Viceland food colleague, Action Bronson. Mm. They share a lot of things in common, except Maddie Matheson is not high all the time like Action Bronson.
Right.
And he is, like I just said, making the stuff for you to learn from, as opposed to just going to a place and eating cool food in cool places. Best of all, he's a big, beautiful, fat man who will take off his shirt in the middle of cooking because
oh,
he just...
Oh, now I know why you like the show.
Because he just gets too sweaty and...
Is he stripped down to the skin?
Fat man making fajitas on television with no shirt on.
That's a health issue.
He's beautiful.
Now let me ask you, given all of this shirt removal and sweatiness, is there an actual recipe that you remember from the show that has transformed your cooking for?
Alonzo.
Alonzo. Okay.
Cannot stand this guy.
Of course.
Because he shouts.
Threat.
He's manic and he shouts all the time.
Yeah.
Not in a Gordon Ramsay, I'm angry at you sort of way, but in a just, he's hyper.
Mm.
And so Alonso doesn't like his presentational style.
Mm-hmm.
But he made a porchetta.
Ooh.
This past week. And in a way that was, like I said, step by step, I'll show you how. Don't be afraid. You can do it. And I made Alonso watch the episode with me. And when it was over, he said, "You're going to do that, right?" And I said, "Yeah, of course."
I love that. I love these promises that we make to our partners. Like, you're going to do that. You made me suffer through this. You're going to make me.
It's a. It's going to be a Sunday afternoon entirely in the kitchen because it's an involved process.
Mm.
But.
And it involves taking your shirt off?
But, yeah.
Here's the funny thing about that. For Christmas, this is a bit off topic, but Alonso...
Not when it comes to you and Alonso.
Alonso gave me an apron for Christmas.
Mm.
A beautiful black linen apron.
Okay.
Gorgeous, right? I didn't even ask for it, but he did it because I burned my belly on a skillet.
Oh!
I want to come over to your house.
I burned my belly. I burned my own big fat belly on a skillet because I was making stuff in my underwear. And
now you know what
I
happens,
would
Pop.
So
Rocketeers.
100% watch this.
In Christmas,
show.
On Christmas Day, he goes, "Put some clothes on in the kitchen. Here's your start. Here's the starter pack of clothes for you to wear in the kitchen." So, yeah, Maddie Matheson and I have something in common.
Oh, that's awesome.
We're both gorgeous and fat, and we cook shirtless.
And you're making the porchetta, which we're all coming over to taste, right?
You're invited.
Now I'm looking forward to our shirtless brunch.
Yeah.
Our shirtless Pop Rocket brunch.
When guests come over, I put the clothes back on.
That's okay. You don't have to.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but we expect porchetta
here.
And maybe a little belly sear. That's going to be amazing. All right, birthday girl Winter Mitchell, tell us what you're all about this week.
I tried. Okay, so Dave and I were sort of like going back and forth about this, but I am struggling with this season of American Crime Story as much as I love and really vouched and really went to bat for us being into this show. I think that the show was the show suffers.
So what episode are you talking about
this week? I'm talking about episode 4.
Okay.
We're on episode 4, and the struggle I think I have, is because the Lake House episode. So I'm really looking for more Versace because that's just who I am. But I'm realizing now through the story and through what actually happened in real life, we're not going to get a ton of Versace because, one, the family didn't cooperate, and two, it's not really about him. He was the end, the finale of this reign of terror, the spree. So we get to the point where we are pre Lee Miglin's murder, and we are in the midst of basically like a domestic squabble between David and between Andrew and David Madsen, who was a former lover that he like impressed at some point. They crossed paths sometime in San Francisco. It didn't work out, and then David ended up either moving or returning to Chicago to become like a really great architect. And Andrew at some point either dated or was obsessed or enamored by David's new lover, who's Jeff. And
so many gay names.
So many
Andrew,
gay names.
David,
that's why
Jeff.
I can't keep it
it's
together.
Really, it's like when I watch Game of Thrones and I see all the beards and I have no idea what's going on.
No, but this is the other thing. This is how little I understand about, not from lack of interest, just from seeing it in happening, like a gay love triangle that didn't really happen. Because with gay men, it's just like, we hooked up and we're moving on. You know, with women, it's like a whole lot of stuff. But they were literally all acting like they hadn't either all hooked up at once or whatever. So anyway, Andrew's still a psycho. He kills Jeff off top, lures him into David's flat in Chicago. Then,
spoiler alert, I should
say. Sorry, spoiler alert. It's also happened 20 years ago,
it's
and it's
true.
Public record.
It's public record, but, you know, people are sensitive.
I know. And so then he ends up going off with David on this sixth day. It was truncated, obviously, for time, but on the sixth day, just marched to his death, basically, to David's death. And they made a stop in a truck stop, and ended up seeing like Amy Mann. I don't think it was supposed to be Amy Mann, but she was performing there. It was like super gay, right? So no, but
that's practically lesbian.
But so the reason why I like the episode is because the episode really dealt with David being a gay man who could not be a gay man, but was comfortable within the community he created for himself. He created like a safe space for himself. Also, the fact about him being an architect seems to obviously loom somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. But then what the episode did, which I thought was really gripping and super emotional, I definitely shed tears, is when he's thinking about the very moment that he could actually just get away from Andrew, who is clearly, at this point, we've learned so much about his psychosis and like how crazy this man is. You have to deal with him because you don't know what's going to happen. His violence is so violent. He makes a choice to either leave or stay, and he could escape from this bathroom of this truck stop, and he doesn't. He returns to Andrew and continues to comfort him as he's dealing with all of these things, even though this man just killed his boyfriend.
Oh.
We end up following them to the lake house, and he's having flashbacks and memories of growing up as a young boy with his very masculine father, who kind of looks like Dave. And
Dave White.
It's
ooh,
crazy.
Oh, Dave, do you know that you're an extra?
You're a doppelganger,
ACS?
A very, very masculine doppelganger.
Right, yeah. No, I haven't caught up to this part of the show yet.
Okay, so you will see this part.
Because the minute Penelope Cruz leaves the screen, I'm like,
you're turning the channel.
Is there some cookies somewhere in the kitchen that I can go get?
Yeah.
That is my question about the fundamental audience for
this.
Because I think that there are ways in which it taps into a particular kind of gay history or senses of gay nostalgia for the 90s.
Yeah.
But then at the same time really abandons that or kind of parries with that through its focus on the psychopathy of,
and I can't speak obviously for Cunanan, and I can't obviously speak for gay men, but knowing what I know growing up in San Francisco with how the community was super important and how when he became like this face of like another new kind of like gay panic,
right,
it was not well received and it was not appreciated.
No.
And so for him to go and remove this person from the safe space they've created for themselves.
And the spaces of trust that get fomented
trust.
And just like, sure, you fucked around with this person who I fucked with and who I was fucking and who I loved.
Yeah.
But like, you know, I am fundamentally, because it's the 90s, in a space of trust because I'm gay and because I want to feel community with you and because I want to feel.
And maybe you won't kill me. And of course you do. And I just think that, you know, I need this show for a lot of reasons. One, because I really love true crime and things that happened when I was a young kid and I remember it. Now I know what my parents feel like. But I also need it to show young gay people that the strides that have been made for them to live freely and to have what they have, even though they don't have it all yet, because there was some straight up terror going on.
Yeah.
Like the gay panic in every single episode, the married men, it's just like stressful. It's stressful.
Try living it as a gay man.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
stressful.
Yeah, yeah.
And I need to understand, just like I want people to understand when they make an interracial show one day about that shit.
What I'm all about this week is the Winter Olympics.
Interesting.
And, you know,
I love the way you said that. Interesting.
Interesting. I mean, you know, we were maybe going to talk about it this week, but we moved on.
Yeah.
But you know, so it fills me with all sorts of crazy feelings, both good and bad. I mean, last night with Nagasu doing her skate to Ms. Saigon music, I was just like, at once, this is so orientalist and disturbing, and yet it is tugging upon my 1989 heart in such a weird and intense fucked up way. I'm having so many feelings. One of the things about this iteration of the Winter Olympics for Team USA is that it's Team Asian America at this point. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, there are so many, all of the guiding narratives, at least of the broadcast television variety that are part of this show, point to so many different, like, very young Asian Americans who are metal hopefuls for the United States in a time where during the opening ceremonies you have Dickbag Pence. And especially in a moment where all the commentary during the opening ceremonies when the United Korean team comes in at the very end and everybody's like, you know, this gives us some sense of hope. And everybody's like, you know, investing in this hope in some way that he's the one guy who sits there with his arms crossed.
Yeah, literally, is that his job now, just to show up and be smug?
Yeah. I mean, my dear wife, Sarah Rebecca Kessler, on Twitter, was just like, I think it's Pence, that she tweeted, like, I think it's Pence's job to either leave sporting events early or sit down when he's not supposed to.
Yeah.
And that is the full definition
That's
of his duties as vice
duties.
President. Yeah. I know. I mean, I can't even go there. And, you know, well, I mean, I know we could talk about so many things related to the Winter Olympics, including the funky gloves. Some people love them. Some people hate them. The fire phallus or fire dick, as Nick Murphy and Megan Martinez on the Facebook group respectively refer
Meg
to the whole
Megan.
Thing.
Oh,
you guys
kids.
Know what's up. You guys know what's up.
They don't even know yet how great they are together.
Yeah, you guys got to go on. You got to go, you know, come to Max Fun, kids. Make a show. Anyway, like, so there's like so much already that's happened. There's, you know, so basically, U.S. figure skating right now is dominated by Asian nations.
The only reason I'm not interested in watching is because their programming scheduling is just out of control. Well, I don't want to watch 6 hours. I want to push notification when Adam is coming to the skating rink.
Right.
I just want to know when shit's coming on.
I mean, I am a cord cutter like you, Winter. So
yeah.
I do watch on like NBC Sports NBC Sport Live, and you can like kind of pick and choose like replays or live shows, and you can like choose between the events. So I skip all the curling, but even though I hear it's a great venue for heterosexual drama, but you know, I mean, all to say, I think if you are a disaffected person in relation to the Olympiad or a sports watcher, there are some stories to seize onto and latch onto, and I hope that we can convert some of these narratives into something affirmative and defying of what our nation currently represents in the world.
Yes, I believe that.
There is a beautiful article on Esquire.com today, and I want to say the author's name is Richard Lawson.
Okay, yeah.
But it's about Adam Rippon.
Oh.
And I think it's called The Bittersweet Beauty of Adam Rippon.
Yeah. Mm.
And it is about what he represents to young gay boys who will see him and feel seen.
Yeah.
Because men's figure skating, as much as I have paid attention to it in recent years, tends to prioritize in terms of its attention the butchy butch, you know, guys who can jump around like Gene Kelly rather than gracefully float like a stair. and here now we have this badass motherfucker who is graceful like a swan and is not only is he openly gay, what was it? Weir, what was his first name?
Johnny Weir
was not out when he was in the Olympics. Think about that.
Oh, I think about it all the time.
He would wink about it, but he had not.
He would literally wear doves in his hair.
Yeah, but he had not said it.
But
because you still weren't allowed to say it. And
it's the glass closet of winter
And finally
sports.
Now we have someone who's not only says it, but throws down a fucking gauntlet to the vice president of the United States, throws his own words back in his face. And when I see the internet recap of his performance, which I still haven't done, but I will, I will get probably a little choked up because this man is important.
Yeah.
Everything he is, all wrapped up in what he is, he is so important right now for The article was talking about how this, when the author was like 8 years old, he and his other little gay boy best friend would pretend to be figure skaters.
Yeah.
And then they grew apart. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his parents were like, well, we think he stopped trying to be your friend because you were so gay acting. Yeah. And then it turned out later that this other little boy grew up to be gay too, and the parents were shocked. And it was because there was nothing there in the culture to show that kid's parents, look, he could grow up to be this.
Wishing wells for boys is figure skating.
Won't that be amazing? Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
All right, kids, let's take a little break here on this note of, you know, oiled up Tongans. We didn't say anything about that, but, you know.
Oiled up Tongans.
He's back.
He's back. but we'll be right back after this message. So I'm a Virgo, and I spend so much time planning my trips, and I'm super anal about it. But I've heard that you can spend less time planning your trips and more time relaxing with the people who you love on Tripping.com. Tripping.com is trusted by millions of travelers and featured by such venerable venues as the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, Forbes, and more. Whether you're looking for a cabin or a beachfront home to get away to this winter, Tripping.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. I wish I'd checked in with Tripping.com before I booked my next upcoming trips. So with Tripping.com, one search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. And you know that I spend all my time looking through all those sites individually. So, I mean, I could condense this whole process by just going to Tripping.com. So don't wonder if you're getting the best deal. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation with Tripping.com. So don't forget, you want to save time and money while booking the perfect vacation rental for your next trip? Head to Tripping.com/rocket today. That's TRIPPING.com/rocket. Tripping.com/rocket, and I promise you will be fulfilled.
Following the news is hard and it sucks.
How do you know which stories are important?
Which sources do you trust in this post-truth world of reactionary journalism?
I'm Brett Black.
And I'm Travis McElroy.
And we host a podcast called Trends Like These.
We cover trending news stories.
We debunk misleading clickbait headlines.
And we always try to throw in a little bit of good news.
In our quest for truth!
So join us every week on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Dave White.
Okay, so we are here in the Pop Rocket studios with our fine or not so fine glasses of champagne.
I've burped up some beefy burps in this time we've been here.
We've been drinking some too sweet sparkling wine.
Some street wine.
And we're here to talk about that holiday of holidays. Is it commercial? Is it deep and true love? Valentine's Day. So I'm going to start off actually asking you both, when was the first time you were made acutely aware of Valentine's Day? And who was your first Valentine? When was the first time you were just like, God, I need to get my shit together. I need a Valentine or whatever it is.
Oh, God. Last year when I realized.
Just last year?
Yes, because.
I mean, you didn't have to deal with a.
Well, you know, I was in the middle of a love triangle. Mm. So my Valentine at the time was the 25-year-old, and I mean...
This is some deep Winter Mitchell stuff.
I know. So, like, I realized, like, shit, I can't keep spending Valentine's days with people that are not, like, I'm not actually truly in love with. It seems like such a false bullshit thing. Mm-hmm. As much as the holiday is a false bullshit thing to me, too, but there's something different about you'll hear this on Wednesday, but there's something different about today for me, because I'm actually like in love deeply with this person. So, and I think about all the Valentines we're going to share together.
Aww.
So it's just, it's different.
Dave, when was the first time you were confronted with this thing called Valentine's Day? Did you ever have to give chocolates to a girl?
First grade. We were all expected to bring little Valentines to class and give them out to, you know, each other. And everyone was supposed to give one to everyone. Like, because there was little, like, little papery ones that had cartoons on them or whatever. And he's like, be my friend, you know.
Be mine.
And then I think that stopped around third grade. Like, we were all much too grown after that age to do that in the classroom. I don't remember it happening after that. Valentine's Day just sort of like blew past me all the time.
Yeah.
And then when I was like an older adolescent, post-adolescent, I was way too punk rock for that shit.
Yeah.
So that was not happening.
It's commercial.
For me. Like, who cares?
Commercial holidays.
Now I like it because it is a holiday. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't like that? It involves candy.
Mm.
We love that. And,
And you know how to make magic with sweet stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I do. But so, as a married person, and I've been with my dude for 22 years.
Wow. That's as long as Winter Mitchell's been alive, everybody.
right. Sure. Thank you, Karen.
We never have made a big deal about Valentine's Day because it's real corny. I mean, it is real corny. But I think the very first time I ever experienced a Valentine's Day from front to back and thought, that was a cool Valentine's Day. Alonzo and I, it was a Saturday Valentine's Day.
Oh, those are special.
And we woke up on that morning and he goes, hey, it's Valentine's Day. What do you want to do? I was like, I don't know. And he goes, what if we go to UCLA tonight and see this 1971 lesbian vampire movie called The Velvet Vampire?
Ooh.
And I said, that's a good idea. And so we did that. But before we did that, we ate dinner at Arby's.
Mm.
And it was perfect.
Nothing says love like horsey sauce.
There were kids having actual Valentine's Day dinners at Arby's.
Of course.
Like in a romantic-y kind of way.
Yeah.
El Torito was like the hot zone.
Yeah. And so as we were eating our beefy cheddars, we were looking at all the other, you know, young little teenage boys and girls there having their Valentine's Day dinners and thinking, this is about as classy as we'll ever be. So then we saw this lesbian vampire movie and it was perfect. That was a great Valentine's Day.
That's beautiful. And I think beefy cheddar is like perfectly speaks to the love that dare speak its name between you and Alonzo. I mean, I think that for me as like a kind of immigrant child, I was like super shocked by this holiday that, you know, because it was, I left the Philippines before I guess I was sentient enough to realize that people do celebrate it there as well. But when I came here, I was just like, I was at school, I was new, I was like fresh off the boat and like wearing awkward clothes and with a bad haircut. And I was just like, what? We're supposed to like give people these like weird little cards and like these breath mint / candy hearts that say be mine.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I choose you, as the Simpsons used to say. And I was like, what the fuck is this? And gradually over the course of time, I became acculturated to it. And frankly, I never had like a proper Valentine sort of, at least in the way that, you know, people experienced it when they were in love in high school, because I was, you know, a repressed, unknown to myself homosexual, trying to be like, I'm just going to give Valentine's to my best gal pals and I love them all. And this is like love, platonic love and the whole deal.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't really until, you know, there have been so many, many serial monogamous relationships I've had as a lesbian through many years have like allowed me to adjust or acculturate to like different ways of imagining, experiencing Valentine's Day, rejecting it, basically doing some of the things that you said you do, Dave, around like you and Alonzo do around like, you know, like doing something that is really expressive of who you are as a couple with the person who you're with.
Yeah.
A little bit of background before we get into the nitty gritty of pop cultural representations of romance, love, and Valentine's Day. So y'all know that, you know, the origins of the first Valentine's Day was very much bound up with religion, actually, and with the martyrology of Catholicism. And, you know, it's just like, yeah, totally, right? And there were actually, like, you know, there were like two St. Valentines who were martyred, the Valentinuses, Valentine of Rome from the 3rd century and Valentine of Terni, who was a 2nd century bishop from a place called Interamnia. I mean, whatever, that sounds made up. I mean, both were actually beheaded. So these martyrs for Valentine's Day were beheaded for proselytizing Christianity. But actually the darker association with Valentine's Day comes from the Roman era. When it used to be this kind of festival between February 13th and 15th, it involved goat and dog slaughter and male nudity, kind of like your cooking show that you're talking about, a kind of toplessness.
Yes.
And that women used to have to line up to like get beat down by these dudes, because the more beat you got, the better your fertility.
That's 100% not true.
What? How?
It explains everything about why the 50 Shades series debuts on Valentine's Day. Anyway,
ancient origins of He Hit Me and it felt like a kiss.
I mean, of course, the associations we have with romantic love come from literature. We just talked about this last week, lovers. But, you know, it's like Chaucer was really the first kind of British literary author to talk about Valentine's Day in this poem called The Parliament of Fowls, written in the 1380s at some point. And, you know, and it really talked about like courtly love, these forms of courtship and engagement that Barbra Streisand so beautifully lectured about in The Mirror Has Two Faces. In any case, those are the origins of, you know, what we think of as V-Day, Valentine's Day. And we all know that it's basically like a Hallmark card holiday. That said, it informs so much of how we feel about like romances as they're depicted in popular culture.
Yeah.
So let me ask you. If it wasn't Valentine's Day itself or the need to have a Valentine to script your relationship to love and romance, what were the grand sweeping cinematic or televisual romances that told you this is what love is? I mean, was it like Dr. Zhivago, Love Actually, Moulin Rouge?
Before Sunrise, Before Sunset.
Oh.
That whole Jesse and Celine. I just like the idea that love doesn't happen in a tight
pattern. In a flash.
No, it doesn't happen in a flash. It literally happens. There's 3-year distance, I believe, between the first two. And then I think it's like something like 10 between the second and the third, and just watching sort of the journey that this couple takes, you're infatuated with them because they're infatuated yet not really lending themselves to the infatuation until, you know, they're actually a couple.
Yeah.
I really love that, those movies. And I don't even like anything they do independently. Mm-hmm. I don't watch Julie Delpy movies. I don't.
You don't buy Ethan Hawke's novels?
I don't buy Ethan Hawke's novels. But, you know, like, I do love sort of the saga of this couple and seeing them from the very beginning into like
those backpacker days.
Yeah. Well into like, you know,
to the twinkle lights, Norm porn in the backyard days.
Yes.
No, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, that is one thing that the before, since, after series does, is that it creates a longer arc around love. Which, whereas, you know, most of the time when we think about romance, and this is kind of linked to the very notion of romantic poetry or like, you know, the romantic movement, is that like, romance is about peaks and valleys and like the highest highs and the lowest lows.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I personally was crafted a really elaborate relationship to The English Patient back
did.
In, you know, I mean, I was an English grad student. And, you know, it's like it came from literature. And I was just sort of like, and of course, the depictions of hot, like, tortured love, often around infidelity, actually, are what fuel these narratives. And I mean, I remember, you know, I have lines memorized from that film. I won't go through them, except for, am I K in your book? I think I must be. But, you know, I mean, like, you know, there's something to be said about these the notion of a tragic romance that makes it enduring, because romance in its longevity can seem kind of boring. You know, because we have another gay in the room, I'd like to think about, like, you know, the concept of, like, queer LGBT romance. And, you know, how little, how often, how well they've been represented, or, like, you know, because I know that I had to connect onto so many different things as a young person growing up with, like, you know, perverted homosexual feelings. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of insinuating myself into stories, projecting myself into things from Phantom of the Opera. And I, of course, guess who was the... Guess who was the fucking Phantom? To, you know, something like When Harry Met Sally, which is about how friendship that's not meant to become erotic or meant to become a love relationship becomes a love relationship. I think When Harry Met Sally is a locus classicus of, like, romance, especially for people, you know, thinking their way beyond that hot fever pitch, I knew immediately kind of thing. I knew I loved you before I met you.
And I think that one still holds up.
It totally holds up. But you know, like, it's sort of like, you know, when you were younger, what were some of the, or like, you know, as you were moving through the world.
Weirdly.
Where were the places that you went to for the queer romance?
I shut myself down. Mm. Personally, just as a person, I shut myself down and didn't allow myself to project myself into any kind of love stories on screen or in television. It wasn't until my early adulthood, I came out what I consider to be comparatively late. I was 24. Mm-hmm. But those final 4 to 5 years before coming out, I started taking notice of isolated queer moments in films.
Yeah.
And the most burned into me example is... when I saw My Beautiful Laundrette.
Oh, that's a great
1985 film with Daniel Day-Lewis. And he and a young Pakistani man in London, they have a laundromat.
Mm-hmm.
And
based on the Hanif Qureshi.
Exactly. Novel. And I walked into the film not really knowing anything about it, just that it had been getting good reviews. And I would go to see any movie. And so... it was so popular that it was playing at a multiplex in Dallas, which was strange. This is an art house film, but it was playing at a multiplex in a mall. And I walk into this movie and Daniel Day-Lewis walks up to him in one scene and licks his neck. And I felt this hot fire on me. Like everyone sitting around me could see me freaking out that a man was licking another man's neck and wondering how I was supposed to react to that, because I was not going to have those feelings at all about anything. And then a few years later, I saw Prick Up Your Ears, which, spoiler, ends in a murder. And
so many of those films that, as you know, in our generation are...
My Beautiful Laundrette ends happily.
Yeah.
Which was another freak out shocker for me. But Gary Oldman and Alfred Molina fuck their way through that movie so brazenly.
I've not seen this movie.
That
you're downloading that shit.
I remember seeing it with a female friend at the time with my sweatshirt on my lap.
Yeah. Of course you did.
Because, don't tell us about the sweatshirt.
Because reasons. And I, again, I was not out, and I could just, it was like electricity was like...
Oh, she knew,
Harming me.
She knew.
Yeah.
Your friend knew.
And so, when I finally did come out, I was able to experience, the new queer cinema, because it was just around that time.
Yeah.
And everything opened up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's sort of the era that I came out in.
Yeah.
I mean, I was 19 when I came out in 1993. And I mean, so much of my life had been spent projecting myself onto all of these different other narratives, these classic romances, most of them tragic, because as right. it also turns out, in a lot of the things that were first resonant with me, like lesbians just die in movies, right? So,
yeah.
you know, or on TV. So, you know, a show like Northern Exposure, when it did the Sicily, Alaska episode with Sicily and Rosalind. Mm-hmm. I've talked about it here before. That was so hot and dreamy and wonderful. Whoa. But again, the lesbian dies. Even a closeted film like Fried Green Tomatoes, I'm just like, shit, you know, this is sexy. There's like a girl with a vest and like a tie and like a gun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's her name? Mary Louise Parker.
In Boys on the Side?
Mary Louise Parker.
Oh, no, in
In both. Yeah. In everything, essentially.
It's everything.
Mary Louise Parker essentially plays that, like, beautiful girl
right.
who dies, who's kind of straight, kind of bisexual, whatever. And, I mean, I think that that's, you know, where so much resided over a course of time. I mean, of course, you know, now we're talking about Call Me By Your Name as an Oscar
right.
contender and the whole thing. But, I mean, you know, just to say that in the realm of also experiencing Valentine's, I mean, I don't know, Winter, like, do you have any, like, kind of queer romances that have, I know that you like Call Me By Your Name a lot, that have been, like, resonant with you, that make you see, like, love differently in a way.
You know what's crazy? I'm thinking about the scene in Who's That Girl? When the cops at the
end. That's not crazy.
No, but the cops at the end decide they love each other and start making out. And it has no rhyme or reason in the movie whatsoever. There was no red herring.
Right.
There was no nothing.
Yeah.
And I remember that was like that was actually the first time I saw men kissing on television. I'd seen men kissing in real life before that. Thank you, San Francisco. But that was just, it came so far out of nowhere that it made me, it kind of was amazing because it made me think, oh, everybody's, it's not just me seeing this where I live. Everybody, this happens everywhere.
Yeah.
They're in New York or whatever. But then I always think about sort of like the Torch Song trilogies and a lot of
God,
those.
So beautiful.
You know, those, a lot of those movies or documentaries or musicals that became movies, whatever, during like the early 90s, those were sort of my introductions to it. The Philadelphia, even though that ends on such a freaking
sad note. No, I know, but it
note.
Was, yeah.
Right.
That to me was love because that was my experience. And unfortunately, I lived in the center of just
all of those wrenching
losses. And so when you're a little kid and you're 13, they are selling you this narrative, which thank God is no longer true. Mm-hmm. Gay men are just dying. So when you see like this love story, I remember being like 13 and seeing it. They actually showed it to us in school and just crying because it was Antonio Banderas was his lover
right.
in that movie.
Right.
And just the love that they had for one another. And that if I'm talking about something that I can relate to, it was sort of those experiences in my childhood.
I'd like to think that that scene from Who's That Girl is the precursor of To Chuck and Larry.
Was it To Chuck? What is that? I fucking hate that movie.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's a despicable movie, but I keep thinking about, we didn't get to this part yet, but I was going to talk about Punch Drunk Love and how the Emily Watson and Adam Sandler's relationship in that movie, just because he makes such terrible movies and a lot of them always have to do with him casting his dream girl to be his love interest or whoever the dream girl is du jour. And for him to go so far off the beaten path, because it's Paul Thomas Anderson, it's a completely different venue and vein. I think that's one of my most favorite love stories. Just two, like, mentally not 100% people loving. Like, you think it's not possible. I'm proof positive that you can be slightly not well, unwell, and fall in love with somebody who is
there
too
are
slightly
two
unwell.
Very sweet queer romance films. One that came out in the 90s and one in the ooze, 2001 or two. A British film called Beautiful Thing about two
so
teenage boys who find each other. Mm-hmm. And I remember one scene very just particularly, they are just kind of running around a forest, sort of like playing tag.
Being joyous.
And being playful and joyous because so, even in 2018, so few queer kids get to be teenagers in love. Mm-hmm. And Mama Cass's Make Your Own Kind of Music mm-hmm. is playing during this scene. And they chase each other to a tree and they just kiss. And this audience that I saw it with of middle-aged gay men who had never been able to have that experience went, yeah. And so it's this really moving film. Big Eden is another one. A straight up fantasy about a small town in Wyoming where the whole town of old, you know, rednecky people conspire to get these two guys together. And they very, very Gilmore Girls-ish, you know, make it happen, like putting them in the same
like
place.
A make-cute.
Like, yeah. And it's this fantasy of what would it be like if you never had to leave your small town because everyone wanted to kill you? You know?
Yeah.
And so it's that I would recommend both of those.
Happier Brokeback Mountain. Yeah. But looping back a little bit to this notion of pairings that we get accustomed to on the screen. Like you were talking about Adam Sandler, and choosing an unlikely pairing in
Emily Watson,
not Emma Watson. That would have been creeptastic.
Really weird. She would have been seven.
But let's talk about, like, I mean, you know what? Recent cinema has given us some pretty frequent pairings between people. We have Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, who are in three movies together. Mm-hmm. Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler, three movies. Bradley Cooper and J-Law, four movies. Gosling and Emma Stone, three movies. And, of course, the grandest pairing of all, Tracy and Hepburn, nine films between, you know,
but I think they're just trying to create that. They're trying to recreate
You think they're
that.
Manufacturing it? Or do
they're
any of you have any attachments
it.
To these love teams?
I don't have any attachment anymore to, like, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. Like, I feel like they did what their job was to do. And
they both had curly hair in the 90s, and that was amazing. Curly.
And they, I salute their service. I also don't think that I want to continue to have manufactured pairings because studios.
It's not just like the chemistry is so crackling. I mean, I mean, my complaint about the film Joy. Was that there wasn't enough Bradley Cooper, Jennifer Lawrence interaction. Because I kind of find them, like, really adorable and sexy together.
I find them adorable and sexy. Yeah, I do.
Of the bunch currently,
mm-hmm.
those two together have what I believe to be more natural on-screen chemistry.
Sure.
Than Emma Stone and Gosling.
More than Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. Much more... Don't even get me started about the Drew Barrymore, Adam Sandler bullshit. It's not a thing.
Although The Wedding Singer was a sweet movie. And that couple, Julia Guglia, the potential Julia Guglia and Robin.
Maybe. But the friendliness between Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper is evident. Mm. And they are clearly enjoying each other. Like, they're enjoying each other as colleagues, as actors. They're enjoying each other as characters.
Yeah.
And I like watching them together do that thing.
Sure.
In the same way that Hepburn and Tracy did that very same thing. Because guess what, y'all? They weren't fucking.
Because everybody was like.
Yeah. That was not.
Catherine Hepburn.
That was not romantic.
Were they not having sex?
No.
Catherine Hepburn was a lesbian.
Yes, she was.
Spence and I were good friends. Yeah, the whole thing.
Yeah.
I thought they were lovers.
No.
Well, I mean, maybe, who knows? Maybe that
I'm
went
sure they were very close. But what they really were on screen was perfect together.
Yeah.
They kept
on-screen
each
chemistry
other.
Can't be bought.
They kept each other on their toes.
Or it can.
We watch, Alonzo and I watch Desk Set every Christmas. It's one of their lesser known films.
But those two just crackle.
Set at Christmas time, and so we kind of like it as a Christmas movie. But they are bam, 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 bam with each other through the entire film.
Yeah.
And it's delightful to
but
watch.
But I don't think outside of J-Law and Bradley Cooper, who have been largely absent, I guess, except for, well, Mother. But I just don't know who's out there that I've seen that I've been like, you know what? This, like, I can't talk about a more uncomfortable pairing than Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt in Passengers. Like that movie.
Well, no, I mean, there's just somebody, anybody with Chris Pratt is very uncomfortable. Speaking of Chris Pratt, I mean, I do want to talk, like, so let's transition to, though, like a quick chat about fictitious couples who have emerged as ideals for us in this contemporary era.
I know.
And there have been a few, you know, there have been a few who've been, like, recommended to us from some of our Twitter followers. One that was suggested multiply was Leslie Knope and Ben Wyatt from Parks and Rec.
They're the ones.
Elizabeth Brahe, Nick Wester, P.I., those two folks recommended Leslie and Ben. I mean, I love them too because it's also just like, it's an interesting kind of, you know, feminist reconstituted man romance. Mm-hmm. And I know that, Dave, you find them great. Also, we, of course, have Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung in The Mood for Love. Jim and Pam, classics from The Office. Mm-hmm. Nicole Humphrey suggested that. Julian Robbie from The Wedding Singer. There's Harold and Maude. And people have talked about Eleanor and Chidi from The Good Place. But I don't know. Are there on-screen characters whose romances you emulate or feel resonate with who you are and what you want out of love, or just like give you pleasure when you see them?
This is going to sound stupid crazy, but Alan and I always debated that the other person was the Kanye in the relationship.
Oh, so one of you is Kanye.
No, I would always
and one
be
of
like,
you is Kim?
I think... It goes back and forth, though. Mm. Like, it definitely 100% goes back and forth. Like, sometimes he's like Kanye on the way off into the universe with his anger. Not in terms of, like, he gets angry, just, like, the way he works himself up, like, mad genius-y. Mm-hmm. And then my response is to calm him down, whatever he's upset about. And Kim, I think, has to do it in such a way that still makes her exude, like, control and sexiness and, like, you know, all these things. But then it kind of goes back and forth where I start getting like creative Kanye. It's like a Barbie doll, and I'm just like all in my head about like, no, it has to be just like this, it has to be, we're gonna have to make it just like that. And he's like, whatever you want, babe, that sounds great. And so I feel like there is a very, we both have like big dreams about the things that we want, and we'll stop at nothing except murder to get to it for ourselves.
Except for murder.
So like we just want things, and we want them to be very specific. And I think that's a very Kim and Kanye way of life.
I expect a heavy Kimye thematic.
Oh, you're
nuptials, dear.
A huge Kimye thematic. You have no idea.
Okay, what about you, Dave White? If you could pick one of these pairs, or like a pair of your choosing.
I like all these pairs. I think they're all great. I love the Parks and Rec one, obviously. 1967's Two for the Road, starring Audrey Hepburn and Albert Finney.
Oh, yeah.
It is a film about a couple and their marriage over the years and the ups and the downs of that.
Have I never seen that?
It is Alonzo's favorite movie. And I, for years, thought, why is this your favorite movie about marriage? Because they fight so much here. And he's like, I don't know. I just think about us. When I see this movie, I go, we barely fight at all. And he says, yeah, but no matter what happens to these people in the movie, they stick to it. Mm-hmm. And I've now seen this film like 10 times because of him. And I finally get it. Because romance is kind of a silly thing.
It is.
And once it's done, once you
are... have something to be into.
You better be into that person, mm-hmm, to get up every day and do that thing with them for years and years and years and enjoy them on that level. Then I think of these two films as sort of part one and part two. There's a 2006 film from Sarah Polley, Canadian actress turned director, called Away From Her. It stars Julie Christie and a Canadian character actor named Gordon Pinsent. Mm. They are a couple who've been married for 40 years. She develops signs of early Alzheimer's. Voluntarily goes to an Alzheimer's residential facility before she gets any more symptomatic. And he spends the rest of the film taking care of her, even as she completely falls away from him in her mind, starts having what amounts to an affair with another man in the nursing home because she no longer recognizes her husband. And her husband continues to go every day to take care of her. It's devastating, this film. But what it means to me as a human being in a long, long, long-term relationship, mm-hmm. one that, if we both live, we'll get to the 40-year mark one of these days, you're going to have to do
take
some really
person.
Tough shit down the road. And that's more than swoony looks.
And a stare-like dances and the whole thing. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that moves me most, one of the things that have moved me most depicting coupledom is actually the music video and the song from Death Cab for Cutie, I Will Follow You Into the Dark.
Oh, yeah.
When you watch that music video with those bunnies loving each other and bouncing around and holding each other in the darkness, it just fucking moves you to tears. And whereas my wife, Sarah, and I may have started in the English patient zone because, you know, we got together in a not-so-savory situation, I hope that we will follow each other into the dark. And
now I feel bad for picking Kim and Kanye.
No, come on, honey.
No, that's
Kim is rock and roll. I don't know.
Very, very important.
It's very
choice.
Awesome. You don't need to feel bad about that.
I feel good about it. I just didn't want it to sound like we are superficial and like tawdry for
no,
the sake of it.
No, you're not. I mean, it is.
There's nothing superficial about Kim Kardashian.
There are yins.
I'm not even joking.
There are yins. There are yangs. There are many kinds of romances. All to say, we wish you all a happy Valentine's Day, and we'll be right back right after this.
I love it.
Good
man,
stuff.
Every time.
Well, I hope that you're enjoying this podcast you're listening to as much as we are pretending to. But anyway, why not listen to another podcast, too? It's called The Flophouse.
And on our podcast, we have recently watched a movie, often a bad movie, and we review it on our podcast, but mainly talk about other stuff and, I don't know, hang out.
It's all about hanging out, feeling like you're being with your best friends. Who are your best friends? Us three. Dan McCoy, Emmy Award-winning writer for The Daily Show, Stuart Wellington, owner of the best bar in Brooklyn, Hinterlands, and Elliot Kalin, former Emmy-winning head writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, former head writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Return, so many things. Author of the upcoming children's book,
All right, that's enough.
The Elliot's credits just go on and on.
Yeah, but if you like the idea of listening to three funny guys talk about bad movies, then why not come over and listen to The Flophouse? It's available at MaximumFun.org or wherever fine podcasts are found.
So get out of here.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Dave White.
So every week on Pop Rocket, we ask a question. And this question is going to be asked first of Dave White. And that is, what's your jam, Dave White?
I have been watching Love and Hip Hop Miami a lot lately. It is appropriate for this episode because there is a gay love triangle going on in this season.
Oh, and, good. Finally.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And it's
Miami. It's
riveting.
Hip-hop.
And I'm super into it. But even if that weren't the case, it's got Trina and Trick Daddy.
What?
And I love
what?
Trina so much.
Isn't she the best?
She's the best. And she was like the big fish that got away when I used to work at this gay magazine about 15 years ago. They let me do anything I wanted this magazine. I could interview anyone I wanted. It was always like, pick a lady to be a gay icon for this issue, and I talked to her on the phone. So I got to talk to Nancy Sinatra and Yoko Ono and just authors that I like Lisa Carver and people like that. And finally I was like, let's get Trina. I could never get Trina on the phone. And it was a deep... deep loss for me that we could not get Trina on the phone. Anyway, so now she's on Love and Hip Hop Miami. Because I've been watching so much of Love and Hip Hop Miami, I've just been thinking about Pull Over so much and listening to it every day for about a week, and this song is the best.
I love you for picking this.
I love it. Let's hear it.
Man, this brings back memories. God, I love her.
Oh, that is like, that's some good shit. That
I saw
like
a bear go-go dancer pull a corn dog out of his jock strap and eat it while dancing to this song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That alone recommends the song to all of us.
Thank you for that visual tonight.
I mean, you know. So, Winter Mitchell, give us your jam this week.
Okay. Look, I had to sit with this. I'm not proud of this. I like this song. I don't love this song, but I think that it will help me mend whatever leftover feelings I have from the Super Bowl, which, look, I wasn't here for the 2 weeks after the Super Bowl happened. I thought his halftime show was shit, and I said as much on the Facebook group, but fuck.
Timber fake.
I like this fucking song.
This Man of the Woods.
Your filthy hands all over me. Notice
a clean version. And what you gonna do? You don't even have to like it.
I mean, filthy. It's filthy, right?
It's filthy.
That's a song. I mean, also, that's what he opened with on the halftime show, which everybody's like, it sounds weird, but that's how it's supposed to sound.
I think that I need to make peace with what occurred on that field, which was simple tragedy, but
you were talking about that sheet.
The sheet.
You tweeted about that sheet, honey.
I said that sheet is, you're not just going to unfurl bedding at a halftime show in my memory. And if you're going to actually memorialize me, spring for the hologram, don't just unfurl a sheet. Look, really quickly, I think that he had an entire show plan, and he choked at the thought of being in front of these people, not giving them what they want, not having Janet, not having special guests, not anticipating sound problems, not being, you know, I think that this was just bullshit. Mm. But I like the song enough. It's whatever. It's also January. No, it's February, but I can dump anything in this
it's
time.
It's very listenable. I mean, it's, you know, Man of the Woods is very listenable. Yeah. So, I mean, regardless of the...
It's a C+.
Yeah. I mean, and sometimes that's great. All we need for a jam.
That's true.
Okay. Speaking of which, my jam this week actually comes from a band who we all loved back in the aughts when, you know, they were making that atmospheric music to Garden State or that was soundtrack to it. And it's The Shins. And The Shins are a great band. And, you know, Jason Mercer is a wonderful musician. But they did this thing this year where they immediately made an album after an album not so long ago called Heartworms in 2017. They made their kind of bizarro remix. It's not even a remix. It's like a bizarro universe funhouse mirror to their album Heartworms, and it's called The Worm's Heart. And so this song is the eponymous track Heartworms in its bizarro flipped version. So let me play it for you.
I just symmetry lies of fundamental difference. There are those who own the minds and those who crawl. No offense, but in between the lines I'm reading. You look out for your own, and you ain't gonna look at me that way. And it's true. So what can I do?
So, you know, this sounds like, I mean, it's kind of like it almost borrows from that, like, Robin playbook, kind of dancey electronic feel. Let me play you a little snippet of the original just so you hear the transformation. You know, here we go.
Behind your symmetry lies a fundamental difference.
And this sounds very Shinzy. This is what we're very familiar with. This is what, you know, we visions of Natalie Portman and Zach Braff in our eyes and our 2004 selves. All to say, it's worth a real listen to these two albums together, actually, as an exercise. So jam on it. I'm not just giving you a song flipped, but I'm giving you two albums to listen to this week. All right, folks, so you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me this week, Karen Tongson, with my dear Winter Mitchell and our special guest, the linoleum knife / velvet lawnmower, Dave White. So, Dave, where can our listeners find you anywhere in the world? What's your address?
You can go listen to Linoleum Knife, which is the film podcast that I co-host with my husband, Alonzo Duralde, who is in turn the co-host of Who Shot Ya? Here on the Maximum Fun Network.
That's right. Way to plug the network, sweetie.
Yeah.
And you know, as always, our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Is Mariah Carey Okay? And you got to write that shit down for next year's Pop-Tarts.
I know.
And Quiznwa for the 5-star reviews in Apple Podcasts. If you haven't already reviewed us, please do. Quiznwa says, I enjoyed the Who's Your Coven exercise. Thank you, Louis Bertel. Quiznwa's coven includes Bette Midler, Michelle Obama, Elizabeth Warren, Emma Thompson, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
That's a good one.
That's a pretty tight coven.
Yeah.
So get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and join our very active discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the extra cuddly Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.